Welcome to Big Talk for Breeders. My name is Michael Doherty, a show jumping breeder from the west of Ireland. And in each episode, I'll bring you a new interview with a successful sport horse breeder. Thanks for checking out the podcast. Now let's get started. This is episode number 45 with Irish Olympic event rider and breeder, Pádraig McCarthy. Originally from County Tipperary, Pádraig runs MGH Sport Horses at Warren Farm in England with his wife Lucy and family. We cover a lot in this episode, from Pádraig's early days and influences growing up in Tipperary, to his motivations for leaving Ireland to pursue opportunities with greats like Rothcorn Bengston, Max Howery, and Hans Horn, and some of the learnings from each of those experiences. We look back at Pádraig's experiences of juggling horses alongside his university pursuits, meeting Lucy and relocating to the UK. Pádraig gives us a thorough overview of his breeding program, and we delve into the qualities that Pádraig looks for when breeding or sourcing young eventers. Due to a number of other projects, particularly the Army Equitation School Centenary Series, that I hope you've all had a chance to check out, I'm conscious that quite a lot of time has passed since publishing the last episode of Big Talk for Breeders, but I'm confident you're going to enjoy this conversation with Pádraig McCarthy. Over the past 10 or 12 years, you have achieved a lot of very special milestones and results in the world of eventing. But the path to getting there has been a very interesting one, full of twists and turns. And I think it's very easy for people that might click into this episode or conversation that are familiar with your results in recent years that won't know that story. Can we go back to the earlier days of you growing up in Tipperary to kind of touch on some of those early day influences in terms of those people and moments that were your kind of earlier tastes of the equine industry and what really got you going at the beginning?
Well, I grew up like a lot of people in rural Ireland. All we had, I suppose, in terms of sport was the GAA, and everybody in school played the GAA, and that was what was available to you. There was no computers. We had two television channels, and it was just the way of life. Things were simpler. My father was on Garda Síochána, so a policeman, and my mother was at home most of the time. So life was pretty simple. My sister, we didn't have any horses, but I think my parents would have ridden as kids from a farming background. My mother, they had pony to take the milk from the farm to the dairy. My father would have had, from his friends, ridden a little bit in hunting, but we never had any horses growing up. But my sister, every time we would be driving and pass the gypsies on the side of the road, she always said she wanted a pony. So eventually, Dad kind of caved in, and we got an ex-racing pony from our cousin Tim Beecher. And it was pretty wild, but it kind of got us started. You know, you couldn't leave him off the lead rope. I think at that stage I was 10 or 11. It was the first time I sat on a pony, and kind of instantly clicked with me. Because I was never very good at GAA. I was never very good at football, and horses always, I had an interest from the beginning, really taken with it. So we started going then on a weekly basis to local riding school in Kennedy's Riding School in Carrigonshire. And then we got, I think, a more quiet pony that we started riding on, and very shortly we were buying and selling a lot of ponies, and we were fully involved, everybody, all kids, and we had ponies at the neighbors, in the neighbor shed. We didn't have any setup ourselves. We lived in the middle of the village, so it was pretty simple at the beginning. We didn't have a sand arena. We used to just hack up the roads, and on the side of the main road there was a little bit of green area. We used to ride around into the forestry, up and down the tracks. I think like a lot of people at that time, you know, life was very simple. And then we started doing a little few shows, gymkhanas, and it kind of grew from there. But I think before that even, I used to go to school with two boys called Desi and Jamie Murphy in Grange Mochler, County Tipperary. And it was kind of well known around the village that their grandfather had bred this great horse called Boomerang that Eddie Mackin rode. So that was always kind of, you know, in your mind. And I kind of became always very curious about that and this great horse. And so that was kind of there. And I always, from very early days, looked up to Eddie Mackin as being a great role model and somebody you'd like to try and idol, or, you know, be a bit like, you know, from the very early days. So, yeah, started very simply anyway, Michael.
To start at 10 plus in, we'll call it even in modern times, when we're so used of the riders that are coming through now at that age, they're probably already on teams and it's very professional from a young age. You started at 10 and you were hooked very early on. Do you, looking back, can you see why? Do you know what it was that was the hook? Apart from maybe having to avoid going playing Gaelic football or being drafted for any local teams.
I don't, to be honest. I think everybody has something that works for them. I think, is it Winston Churchill said that there's something about the outside of a horse that's good for the inside of a man.
Yeah.
That kind of, it just made sense to me. I always like being around the horses and working with them. Don't think anybody knows why they're particularly interested in anything, but I was probably a pretty quiet young fella. My brothers were a bit more gregarious than I was, and I felt comfortable on ponies. It kind of made me feel good about myself, and I know a lot of people nowadays. I think William Micklem is a big advocate of the benefits of riding for young people, and I
Yes.
strongly agree with that. I can't give you a more exact answer. It's just made sense to me, and it was something that I really enjoyed doing.
From that interest, it sounded like it very quickly was snowballing into your sister begging for a pony, your parents giving in to then, buying and selling a lot. But from the riding side of things for you, who were the people at the beginning that, I guess, from outside your family that took the interest in you initially or gave you the extra time or encouragement that kind of gave you a bit more of a hunger for it or for the competition side of things?
So early on, I suppose, well, we kind of fiddled away a little bit ourselves as young kids, and did all the gymkhanas and kind of got a little bit better at the ponies, the jumping and that. And then I think, I don't know if you know the name Jim Hickey. He's a performance
Yes,
coach
yeah.
now. Jim was also very keen, and his family were like Eamon Hickey, his brother's a good friend of mine as well. Jim was working in the bakery in Clonmel at the time. They had the bakery at the West Gate in Clonmel. And I don't know how the connection, we got the connection there, but became friendly. And he used to come out a lot of evenings and afternoons and help. And was very passionate even then. He's still very passionate about horses and helping people. And he helped me a lot. Our farrier, even Paddy Fives, was from a good horse family. And I think when you're interested and you're hungry to learn, as you know, like people will want to help you. And I was always asking questions and always trying to be a bit better, I think, even without consciously knowing it. And I think people gravitate towards a young person's hunger to learn. So those people, they really helped me. And I know that Jim's brother John was in Sweden
Yeah.
for quite a long time at that stage, and Eamon was as well. And I think it was through those guys that I then got the chance or the connection to Rolf Göran Bengtsson and the opportunity to go there when I was 18. So that was really to go to a yard like that very early on was something that was really special and really put me in the, give me an idea what it was like to be in the top yard and see how it works. And I think gave me even more hunger to do it,
To get that opportunity or seek it out or to take it, there was obviously some decisions that had been made in your own mind in those years before that this was something that you wanted to pursue professionally.
When I look back on it now, like I think there's a we see you spoke earlier about a lot of the young kids coming out now and being really successful from a young age, and a lot of those kids are coming from parents that have ridden to a high level, so there's an infrastructure around them. I didn't have any of that, so it was a lot of it was kind of feeling my own way. And the next thing, there was nothing at home really, it was very simple. And I was just hungry to get out and to find people who were good at it. And I was keen to travel. So, when I got the opportunity to go, I went very quickly at 18, as soon as I finished school. And I spent a year there. And it was a, really great, fantastic opportunity. I learned so much from Rolf Göran. He was an unbelievable worker, a great horseman. And I got the opportunity to ride a lot, so that really was really helpful.
What were your expectations going out there? Like, did you know what you're signing up for going out there in terms of the expectations versus what the reality turned out to be? But also, was that a daunting process for you? Like leaving home, heading away internationally at that stage?
So no, I didn't know what was expected of me. I probably didn't even ask the question. I was so desperate to get out of small town Ireland. I'd realized that if I wanted to do it, I needed to go somewhere where there was, first of all, the opportunity to get some help. And I was just hungry to go, like Ireland at that time, and it was pretty simple, especially our setup at home. Like mom and dad did everything to allow us to start in the pony job, and they, from very simple means, we had great opportunities with lots of different ponies, and we actually could pay our way with them through the buying and selling. But to get on in the sport, I needed to go, so I went with very little expectation. I knew that Rolf Jørgen had a lot of stallions, breeding stallions, and so I went there just to get going. And the second part of your question was,
Was it a daunting prospect?
not when I made the decision. I guess getting on at the time, there was no, you had to fly to Copenhagen, and it was in the middle of winter, and get on the boat from Copenhagen to Sweden, and like it was full of ice on the sea even, and getting to Sweden at minus 20 degrees in the dark at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I was starting to think, what have I done,
Yeah.
and it wasn't cushy. Like we lived in myself and Paul O'Shea were there at the same time, actually. We started together there, and we lived in a loft above the house with no heating, so it wasn't cushy. We worked a lot, but I learned so much, and I'd do it again in a heartbeat. So I think, and that's another thing that I think has probably been very fortunate, or a blessing for me, that I've always been quick to take an opportunity without too much expectation. I see it nowadays when people ring you and they have so many questions. They nearly, in my mind, put themselves out of the job before they even get here. I've been to a job before, and the person I went to work for, they were asking me what I had expected, and I said, look, I'll come for a month and I'll work, and we can have a chat after a month and see if it worked for both of us. And that worked out always very well for me,
Are there things from that year in Ralph Gormbengsen's that you would still see in your own approach, like how you do things, either running a business or in riding or your approach to horses? Is there anything that you still would attribute to your time there?
In one way or another, when those years are very formative. His work ethic really struck me, like he was a real worker. He has had great success, and I think you don't get too far on this board without having that work ethic. The other thing that always really struck me there, and I particularly once we went to a show where he was riding, and one of his cousins had a difficult horse, and it was napping in the practice ring, and it was standing up in the arena, and he asked Rolf Jørgen if he would ride the horse, and he rode that horse in the 120 class after. He'd been naughty in the 110 class, and the horse was unbelievably smooth and easy. And I thought, like, that's something to really emulate. And so I've always tried to keep that philosophy that it should go easy with the horses. It shouldn't be a struggle, He was an amazing rider and someone to look up to, So I always, from that point of view, still enjoy to watch him and see how he does it. And, all that he's achieved has been fantastic.
So that was your taste of, I guess, seeing an operation at a very high level. What was the next step in the path from there?
But the other thing I guess to mention there is that they had already a lot of stallions. He was at that time in Sweden. He hadn't, when I was there, he won the Grand Prix in Gothenburg. That was his biggest win to that point, and was then selected for the Atlanta Olympics in '96. And he then a year later went to work for Jan Tops, and then his career really skyrocketed.
Okay.
But there he had a lot of stallions, so they were collecting semen and sending it out, and there was always the various stallion stud books on the coffee table. And again, I would read those books every night and read the pedigrees. And for some reason, that always was very interesting to me. I don't know why, but I just, maybe for the lack of something better to do, I kind of started reading the pedigrees and got into it. I remember all the French stud books, the Holstein books. And from that point, I think was really where I started becoming interested in breeding. So after a year there, I think I'd competed a little bit at low level with some of his homebreds. I got an opportunity to come home. There was one of our neighbors called Tom O'Shea had a good horse that was ridden by, I think, Michael Condon at the time, called Páirc na Cloiche. He was a son of Kildalton Gold. He was a stallion, and he was jumping, I think, 135. And Tom offered me the ride on that horse and one of his younger stallions. So I came home, and And I started to ride a little bit at home, and that was one of the horses. And I jumped my first National Grand Prix with him, 140, and I rode him in the Internationals in Mill Street. And he was a super horse. So I spent, I think, that summer at home. And in that period, I'd, Max Howery, I met, he'd come to our yard to buy some houses or some horses. Max was a very familiar figure on the Irish circuit at the time. And he had asked me a couple of times during the summer if I would go over to Switzerland and work for him. And initially, I'd said I wouldn't because I was having a good time with that stallion. And then in the winter time, I decided, again, maybe it's time to go and see something else. So then I went to Max's in the fall of the year. And I worked there, I think, until maybe March or April the following year. And again, it was a different learning experience, but you saw then the more the dealing side of it. And again, a big operation. Max was an incredibly hard worker and a great horseman. Learned a lot from him and from horsemanship. And but then at that point, I got the opportunity to come back and ride for the Bircher family, and they were keen to have some nice horses. So I came back there, and I worked for them for a couple of years and had some good success. We won the 6-year-old championships in Dublin on one of their Irish draft stallions, again by Kildalton Gold. It was a horse called Ballantyne Gold. So that was, again, I suppose at that point I was just getting a foothold on the competitive ladder myself, having not ridden that many horses in competition before I went to Rolf Urens. I was keen. I needed to keep trying to get in the ring, and I was using the winter times then as probably an opportunity to go away and learn. I think that after being at Max's, I was at home for the summer, and then I went for 3 months. I got the Birchers had bought a stallion from Hans Horn, and I knew at that point that Jos Lansing had spent so much time there and was one of the best riders in the world. So when they bought a horse from Hans, I said to them that the one condition as the part of the deal is that I could go there with the horse and train for 3 months. So I did that. And again, that was a really amazing opportunity again to be in a top stable like that and see how they did it. At that point, Jos had left, and I think Double Dam had been and left, and then it was Jerry Smith was there, and Neil Fearon was actually there at the same time as well. So I think I'd recognize that it was a good way for me at that point, at least, to go away for a period, come back, put it into practice, and it was kind of pattern I did for a few years.
You mentioned just with Max Howery and the horsemanship. At his peak, he would have been one of the largest dealers in the world. He was probably one of the largest buyers to ever be coming and going from Ireland. What were the main things that you feel you noticed or learned from him in terms of like how he would assess a horse or like critique a horse? Because am I right in thinking that when he used to be coming to Ireland before and buying horses, like he was doing his own vettings and everything like that. Everything was just done off his eye and his opinion. There
Yeah.
was no need to be doing multiple x-rays or bringing them off to a clinic or anything like that. It was all just based on what he
Yeah.
saw and felt.
I mean, I think Max just had a world of experience. And again, at that time, I didn't really process it too much what it was about it. But I think he had a real instinct for Irish horses and what they could achieve when I think he could see in them when they were young what they could become when they were older. A lot of Irish horses. They were blood horses. They didn't show the big scope like the foreign horses would. And I think a lot of people would struggle to see the quality in those horses. And one thing that he said to me at that time, and it's always kind of stuck with me, that an Irish horse, like a blood Irish horse, if they can jump a big vertical when they're younger, they'll jump a big Oxer when they're older. And he definitely liked a horse with blood. He didn't mind the sharp one at all. I do remember we always sat at the table at lunch and ate together, and he'd gotten a particularly talented 4-year-old mare over from Ireland shortly before, and thing with all the horses when he got them then is they had to go hack around the village and into the river. And that was always quite interesting because it was a busy village and the river, yeah, that was a big dark hole and they had to go in. And there was a mare, I think she was by Animos Hello, and she was hardy now. And I got the job of riding this mare down the village, and she spent more time on her back legs than she did on all fours. And this day at lunchtime, anyway, I was kind of probably saying how difficult this mare was. And I probably said it once too much. Anyway, Max took a dislike into it and he slammed his hand on the table and said, Addy, he said, all the good mares, he said, they're like the good women. They're all difficult, he said. So I think that kind of stuck with me as well, like that you have to take your time with them. And, just because they're difficult doesn't mean they're not talented, So Those two things, I think, really stuck with me. And he could see through a lot of things that I think a lot of people don't see through. I think what he had an instinct was how clever a horse was and how much they wanted to do it, you know. And that's, you know, often for me, they're still the biggest qualities, a horse that figures out the job and has a heart to try and jump clear rounds in the ring. We all can find it's easy to spot a big scopey jumper, but it doesn't always follow through with the results in the end.
With the initial, we call it curiosity and breeding from Ralph Yorm Bengtsson's and looking through stud books, and then to get the experience to go to somewhere like Hans Horn, who probably at that time had some quite influential stallions, would have been the Libero times. And
So Libero was there. He was finished at the high level, but he was still covering. And Lux Zedd was at his top of his career at that point. Loopy Core was a young horse. Numero Uno was a 4-year-old at that point. And again, Hans was an incredible horseman. So that's for me, I saw probably for the first time, you know, real quality young ones, real quality horses. And what was nice there, you could see how Lux was trained and prepared for big competitions and how to develop the young ones. He was a very good horseman, Hans. Also, he made things very simple in the riding, like it wasn't complicated. And I appreciated that. And again, that's something I try and keep in my own philosophy, that you keep it simple, the riding, like it's not rocket science in the end. You do the basics right and you have a good horse and you give them time. You know, the pieces should fall together. So again, like there from Ralph Jurens and then into somewhere like Hans Horns, and you know, every Wednesday evening that time, you remember, maybe you're not as old as me, but they used to play the on Eurosport, wasn't it, the Wednesday collection? They always showed the World Cup qualifiers on Wednesday, and so I always followed Jos on Libero H, and then to hear the stories in the background about his character and all of that was fascinating. They said again, he wasn't a scopey horse, but he was a real fighter. Yeah, so real great opportunities to learn. Very good for me.
Did those sort of times and experiences like further enhance your interest in breeding, or was that something that was going to come later down the line? Like, it
No, I
was,
did. I think it certainly did. I had already bred from a couple of ponies that I had even when I was younger. And that's something that I've often thought about. And I think being in England has maybe made me more aware of that. I think like the Irish people are intrinsically interested in breeding. And not only from a horse point of view. I think it's very hard in Ireland to speak about somebody without making reference to his wider family,
His
his
breeding.
brother. It would be very common for my father and his brothers to talk about somebody and say he came from good stock. You know, he'd be good to deal with. Came from good stock. So that I've always reflected on that and find it fascinating. But if you ask people about the breeding of a horse in England, they will say it's King of Diamonds lines or Darko lines, and that's it. Or they say it's Irish or it's Dutch. Whereas if you ask an Irish person, they'll generally give you three generations, if not four. And that's across amateur or professionals. And I think it's the same for people. I think English people judge people on who they are and not where they come from. Whereas I think Irish people are just generally more interested in, and I think maybe it goes back to what Freud said about the Irish, that you can't psychoanalyze Irish people because, and that's something I learned later. The reason for that, you probably know it as well, is because he said the Irish people don't see themselves as individuals, they see themselves as part of a wider social mesh. So maybe that's where Irish people are so interested in breeding. I don't know, but I've always mused over that point because I think in general it's a very obvious and noticeable difference between Irish and the British culture.
That's a very interesting point, and it's definitely not something or a topic that I saw this conversation going in. But if you actually,
I'm pissed.
that we'd be discussing Freud. But what is very interesting, actually, when you let that roll through our experience of the horse world or anyone that's listening to this, there are probably few nations that have that collective mentality in or outside of the horse world, like the Irish. And it's something other nations would talk about at the strength, like when there's Irish in the ring, whether it's a team competition or not, that support when young Irish people are looking for jobs or opportunities, that willingness to find it for them or support. They'll be the fiercest competitors against one another when they're in the ring, but be helping each other at the same time. And that's an interesting. It's kind of an interesting mental
It's an
thread there
observation
for
that
that.
I've often, like, in as I got older, reflect upon, like, how we speak about people and horses very different. And it's probably been here has made me more aware of that, you know.
Yeah.
But that's an aside.
Why I think it's particularly interesting going through the different points in your career is it's very easy in the industry to think of human and horses' careers or success in straight lines. And it's such a tough industry that it's very easy to get disheartened. There's so many opportunities for you to stop or turn back or question what you're doing because it's such an industry of highs and lows, and the lows will really test your mental resolve. Despite those, we call it opportunities and getting the exposure to systems like that, there did come a point, maybe a few years later, where you were starting to get a bit disillusioned with a writing career. Would that be fair to say? And you decided to make a bit of a pivot at that point.
That's probably true, yeah. I was, having been at Max Howries and back again in a short period in America, I went back to Switzerland to work for Jörg Notz, and I spent a few years with him, and then competing a lot more at this point. And then I went to work for another Irish guy called Niall Talbot that wasn't far away from there, and enjoyed relatively good success. And like every horse rider, you had ups and downs, but I didn't have anybody that was supporting me with horses or anything. It was working for dealers, and so the horses were always sold. And I think I came to a point when I was about 26 or 7 and thinking, is this what I want to do, like, this day in, day out? And at that point, I decided that I realized that I wanted to do horses in some fashion, but maybe not the way I was doing it. So I thought, if I went to university and got a degree in business, I could maybe get a job, and then I could support my own horses, and I wouldn't have the pressure of riding for in a dealing yard or expecting always to have the results to make sure the horses were sold. And at that point, I saw that would be something that might suit me, you know. So I went back and I did a business degree. I did some time in Germany studying, and I studied in the university in Waterford. And when I finished my degree, I kind of got the opportunity to do a master's. And again, you get nothing for saying no. So I said yes. I got a scholarship to do a 2-year master's. I thought, why not? And I got to the end of that, and they said, would you like to turn it into a PhD? And again, I said, wow, that was something that would be nice to do. And so I said yes to that again. And all the while, I'd kind of, when I went back to university at the beginning, I bought three foals from Jimmy Ryan in Clonmel, who you know.
Yeah.
I thought they'd be, my idea was that by the time I finish my 4-year degree, they'd be nice 4-year-olds that I could start
Yeah.
riding again. So I had some kind of plan. And so I don't know where I should jump forward or backward to, but I guess I'd go to the point when there were four, maybe. One of them was a nice mare by Aldatus out of a Clover Hill mare. She was a sister of a horse called Newmarket Player that was quite a nice jumper. I did some shows with her, and she got a big splint, so I decided to breed from her. And she, I did breed a lot from her. And then one was just a bit more careful, and we sold her at four. I owned them with Paul O'Shea together, the three of them. And the other one was a mare by Courage out of a Clover, a cruising mare. Cruising mare called Kilnamack Polly. And that mare went on to jump 160 with Paul. I started her and jumped her up to 120, and then Paul bought me out, and when he moved to America, he brought her with her, and she turned into a good horse. So
But just
that's
on
kind
that,
of,
because I know the people listening will be thinking that's instant karma, right?
that's instant karma, yeah.
Yeah.
And then I suppose that I was also at that time trying to fund my education, so that was really helpful. And I was on done deal buying horse trailers and washing them and trying to sell them for profit. And you do what you do to try and fund it. But I did my PhD, I guess. I was always tangling here and there, trying to make money to make everything work. And at that point, I had an interesting conversation. Paul O'Shea rang me one day, and he said that he was looking at the Farmer's Journal, and there was a cruising colt for sale in Cork from family Kelleher, Tim Kelleher. And he said to me, would you go down and look at the 2-year? And said, sure. So I drove down to Mallow, one morning, and I went into the house. It was 9 o'clock. They had finished milking. They were big farmers, and I asked them for the passport of the cruising cold. He must have been well bred. I can't remember what he was out of, but they put the passport on the table anyway, and they'd given me the wrong passport. They'd given me the passport for a yearling by King's Master out of Killinemacholly. Now, I know at the time that Instant Karma was a good horse at that point, but I'd asked Jimmy if he still had the mare a few years before, and he said she was difficult to get in foal, so he sold her. So we had lost track of her. So I thought, right, I found this mare again here, and of all places and of all circumstances. So I got talking to him about it, and they had the mare. So I looked at the 2-year-old colt, the cruising, and I didn't think he was that good enough to be interesting for Paul. So I asked him if I could see the King's Master, and I liked him, and I bought him. And I asked him if I could buy the mare, the Killinemacholly, and they wouldn't sell her. And I leased her the following year, and I bred her with Sligo Candy Boy. And she bred then what we called MGH Candy Girl, that won a lot of 5-star speed classes with Matt Sampson. So she was a half sister to Instant Karma. And then the following year, they rang me and asked me if I wanted to buy her. And of course, I bought her. I gave them a lot of money for her. And I think we bred one OBS quality who was an amateur horse. And then she was in foal to Louis Demon, and she died of liver failure, sadly. So that was the story of Instant Karma and that family. So during that, this is the next part of the story, again, to jump forward to where we are now. I had this King's Master horse. And as a 3-year-old, I had him advertised on the internet. I was in the last year of my PhD, I think, in Waterford. And my now wife, Lucy Vigersma, came to look at him. And she liked him a lot and in the end didn't buy him, but we started going out slowly together. And 6 months later, I moved over to England and brought the horse with me. So she got 2 for 1. And he was a good horse as well. He evented to intermediate level before we sold him. And yeah, it was a part of a, well, that was the beginning of my eventing career, really, I suppose, moving over to England and meeting Lucy.
At what stage from obviously when you met Lucy, she had already enjoyed a lot of success in the world of eventing. But at what stage then were, or how quickly were you kind of drawn over to the dark side? Because I don't think that eventing was in your sights at, say, at that stage when you were in Ireland, seemed to be that everything was focused solely on the world of show jumping.
That's right. I never entered my head to be an eventer. I came over here, and even being here, I didn't think about it. Actually, for the first year or so, I was mostly buying and selling horses. And for me at that point, I didn't really see myself coming back into sport even. I enjoyed the riding young horses, and I was breaking a lot of young horses here. Kind of got a reputation for being able to break difficult horses. And I enjoyed the selling, the buying and selling part of it. And I think Lucy had encouraged me even from the beginning that you should start and get my own horses. And it just didn't seem like it was a possibility at that point to me. You know, I knew nobody here. But I think then she had one master in mare that was a bit difficult and said to me that I should start eventing it. And well, I said, why not? It was, again, I don't like saying no too much. And like it was a complete disaster, my first few attempts at eventing. I couldn't find my way in the dressage tests. I was losing my way into cross country. It was a real comedy of errors. But she persisted anyway, and she probably could see something in me that I didn't realize was there. And I think that was probably 2011 or 2012. And then at that point, she had 2012, she had missed out on the Olympic selection on a horse called Simon Perlow that was a very good horse. And she rode him the following year. And he was probably starting, he was about 15, 14 or 15. He was coming towards the end of his career. And at that point, she had a very, very good young horse called Mr. Chunky that was on his way up, belonged to the same people. And they were very different. Simon was a bit smaller striding, and Mr. Chunky had a lot of power and scope. And she said to me that, and suggested to the owners that I should start riding Simon because he was starting to stop a little bit at the higher level. And that it would be good if we should start at the beginning and go as far as I could go with him. It would be a good experience for me. And she felt at the point that the two horses were so different that riding him wasn't helping her ride the better young one. So I started riding him in the beginning of 2014 at novice level. And I think at the end of that year, I did the Nations Cup show at Waregem in Belgium, and at 4-star. And then he was selected the following year to go to the European Championships in Blenheim, or not Blenheim, but Blair. So, like within 1.5, 2 years of starting the eventing, I had the opportunity to go to the European Championships, which was completely bizarre. You know, it happened so fast. That doesn't happen in show jumping. And the following year, I did the Olympics in Rio with him. You couldn't write it, you know. It happened
No.
so quickly to me. I didn't really digest it, I think, till probably a few years later. So then I guess the family started with Lucy. We had our first child in 2015, and yeah, so I think that then probably started her thinking more about family and pushing me more into the taking over the horses, in which I did. And then I got the opportunity to ride Mr. Chunky. And then he obviously went and won a lot, and won medals in the World Championships in Tryon, and he really gave me the springboard to the career I have now, you know.
Was there ever a point when you got back, we'll call it competing, whether, eventing or otherwise, was there ever a point where you still wondered about the show jumping career? Or once you started back out and once you started to find your way on the dressage tests and cross country, was it just solely then eventing from there on in? Or did you ever consider going back to the show jumping roots full time?
I didn't, to be honest, think about going back to it because I had so much opportunity in eventing, and you know, to do championships and to do Olympics. That's the thing that riders dream to do, and with very little, what I saw, I won't say effort, but like it happened so quick to me. I thought like that would never happen in show jumping. First of all, the push you need around you, the money you need, the luck to have the horses, and then also in the end you have to question, would I actually be good enough, you know? So yeah, no, I didn't actually. I was really then fully taking the bull by the horns and thinking, yeah, this is good, you know. I really enjoyed the cross country, and when I started to get to grips with the dressage, and I think that was a slow burn as well, you know. Yeah, I started to really feel that I with good horses, and that you could make a difference, you know. You could actually win some big things. And that, and at the beginning when I started, it just seemed so unimaginable. And suddenly it was happening, you know. I was on teams, and I had, before I realized what was happening, I had 2 silver medals. Yeah, it was
Like,
very
that's
lucky
what's
as well.
wild.
Yeah.
Picture yourself, when you're applying, whether it was in Switzerland or back in Waterford, where you're applying to university because you think, right, I'm going to have to get a job to support having horses on the side. If someone had sat you down and said, okay, roll on X number of years, you're going to have done a European Championship, been to an Olympic Games, and then shortly after that, you're going to have won silver, individual and team at a World Equestrian Games, you would have thought the person was on something. In that such a short space of time to get to do all those things, but not even to get the opportunity even to go to Europeans, I'm sure was already huge. And maybe it was all happening quicker than you could actually process, or you didn't have too much time to sit around and think about it. And then to get to go to an Olympics again, dreamlike stuff. And then to get to go to a championship, World Equestrian Games, but not just to participate in it, to actually come home with 2 medals. It's actually just wild. And that's why I think it's important that we've kind of taken the time to set the scene in the conversation that leads up to this, because it's very easy for someone to rock up as a casual spectator of eventing and going, oh yeah, Bourke McCarthy, but he just did the Europeans and the Olympics, and it's just like, well, he's probably always been here, and like
Yeah.
not question it. As a spectator of the sport, often we actually know so little about the people's background who are riding in front of us, and the twists and turns or self-doubt or moments where you think, maybe I should consider something else.
Yeah.
Even if no more came, even if there was never a medal again, to have done a Europeans, an Olympics, a WEG, and have 2 medals hopefully hanging up somewhere around there in the house.
Covered somewhere, yeah. I think, like, when you get older, you reflect a little bit more. And I think what has been a good thing, as it turned out for me, and I wondered when I was younger if it was a bad thing, is that I didn't ever make too much of a plan. I was always staying open to possibilities. I've gotten to the stage now that, and it's something that you hear said, but I'd almost be careful what I'd wish for because it probably would happen. Because sometimes you think of these things, and then 3 or 4 years later, voila, it happened, and it can be a good thing or a bad thing, right? But I think it's a danger, and I've always been personally a little bit terrified of taking on a job and knowing today what I'm going to do tomorrow and the day after and the day after. Now it's the same with horses, essentially. You're trotting around in circles a lot and doing the same stuff. But to me, it's not a job. It's what I love doing, you know. But so even when I went back to college, it wasn't because I felt that I was giving up on something, but I just wanted to do it in a different way. And I definitely had the feeling when I was younger at that point, like being away in Sweden, time of the Celtic Tiger. Friends of mine that were in school had 3 houses and were earning thousands of pounds a week. And I certainly at that point was questioning, am I doing the right thing here? Like, I feel like I'm being left behind. Suddenly a year later, they were all owing millions to the banks and everything was gone. Things work out. And I think one of my biggest pieces of luck is that I've stayed open to everything and I've never tried to envisage something. If I never had ridden at another competition when I came to England, I wouldn't have felt like I missed out on something. The opportunity came, I took it, and you crack on with it. I do think that when I try to do something, I apply myself as best I can at it and do it as best I can, and then it takes you where it takes you. And for me, the joy of doing anything is actually in the process. It's not where it brings you. Luckily, it can bring you some great places, but I take a lot of pleasure in riding 4-year-olds and working with horses on the ground. And now, if my career stopped for some reason, I would also be happy just to keep working with the horses. That's my life and my passion. So I think from that point of view, I'm very lucky, you know.
So would it be foolish to ask you about future plans and ambitions in the world of eventing then?
No, you can ask. I mean, I'd like to win a gold medal at the Olympics. I'm going to try. I have some very good horses. We have obviously world championships in Aachen this year. I'm shortlisted with 3 horses. They're making the selection next week. It's strong this year. For the first time in many years, we have a lot to pick from. And so if I'm not in the final shout, I would put my hat and tip my hat to everyone. They've all earned their places, which is a great place to be for Irish eventing. I do hope I'm there, but we have to see what happens.
Can you talk me through the kind of the core of your current string at the moment? Maybe give a little bit of insight into who those horses are. Maybe touch on a little bit of the breeding. And I'd love to know the different characteristics, maybe what they have in common or how they differ. Just for those at home, particularly those that are interested in breeding for the sport of eventing, just to hear you talk through a little bit of your string, if you wouldn't mind.
Okay, so the oldest one in my string at the moment is a mare called Lady Ophelia that Dennis Hickey bred in County Wexford. She came to me when she was 7 years old. The breeding is actually, the sire is unknown. The mare is an over-the-river thoroughbred mare that Dennis bred, and she's also the mother of DRC Lady
Yes.
Amaro,
Yep.
very good jumping mare. As far as I understand, they covered that mare. When the boys got interested in jumping, they started using jumping stallions because they were a thoroughbred family originally. They covered a mare with Billy Congo. But when they went to get the book, it didn't match. So they tested against all the stallions that Donald Barnwell would have had at the time, but they never found a match. So it's only the mother recorded on her book. And she's a very interesting little horse. I think Dennis will admit they sold her. They didn't think that much about her when she was young. She didn't show any particular talent. Or certainly not enough talent that they thought they wanted to produce up the levels. And they sold her to a friend, Emma Dehan, as a riding horse in England as a 5-year-old. And when she got her over, she was a little bit sharp. And then Emma, who had ridden a lot, had ridden at 5-star level, she gave her to somebody called Nick Lucy, who started eventing her. As far as I understand, Nick didn't think that much about her. Evented low level, she came to me. I didn't know Emma. I didn't know that she had evented at a high level. And I rode her at one or two events and I met Emma for the first time and she came into the lorry. And I was very unimpressed with this little mare. And I said to her, what's the plan with her? And she said, I'd like her to do badminton. And I said, the grassroots, which is the amateur 1 meter class. And She said no, the 5-star. And I went home to my wife and I said, Emma is completely bonkers. She thinks that mare is going to do badminton. Anyway, she proved me wrong and she did badminton this year and was really amazing. It was was placed there. And she is one of those horses that showed so little talent from my point of view. Very difficult to ride, very difficult character. But she had an unbelievable will to do something in the ring. She always did too much. She went from being a pony club horse to having too much power, too much energy, to the fact that I've been to competitions where I actually didn't go in the ring because I couldn't control her anymore. But now at 14, like you go on the cross country and you think that she's going to jump through fire. And even if she's tired on a Sunday, she's going to kill herself to jump a clear round. And that's a quality that I don't think you can train into a horse, that they have that or they don't. You can for sure channel it and do your best to nurture it. But that's something that's worth its weight in gold. So she has been, even for me, like I've learned so much from that horse because I would have never imagined that she would have done a 4-star, a 3-star even. And now she's done several 5-stars. And she gets better and better with age. So she's been a fascinating horse. Then the one that I rode at the Europeans in Blenheim last year, he was a silver medal in a team, is a horse that I still have from the breeders, the Goff family. And it's by a Spanish Anglo-Arab blood cross called Pompadour. I never heard of him before, but it was a horse that they bought, that the daughter competed at 4-star level. And the mother was an Irish mare by Fioristo, that the daughter competed at badminton in Burley. And they bred a good few from that mare, and Pomp and Circumstances is definitely the best one. He was a very nice young horse, not bursting with power, not bursting with scope, but he always, again, wanted to do the right thing and wanted to go to work. As a 7-year-old, I thought I wasn't sure whether he was going to max out at 3-star level. He had a period where he went a little bit careful, always made good results, but I could feel him that he found it a little bit hard in that period. And then suddenly he got through that, and now he did Kentucky. He was placed in the 5-star in Kentucky. He did several 4-stars, placed in all of his 4-star longs. And he's a really great horse, but he again is a horse that will do everything to jump a clear round on the last day and do everything to go between the flags. And it's a quality that you just cannot overlook or overraise or speak highly enough about. Because to ride him at home in the school, you think he's a 2-star horse, like just a nice, easy person, nothing special about him. But that's why I find that the older I get, the harder it is to judge horses, because that's the quality that we need in them. It's not all the flash. Of course, then there's the next horse that I speak about is MGH Sabayoni. He's one of those horses, I suppose. He's like any superstar where you have everything coming together. He had always looked like he had the talent. He has the breeding. He makes results nearly every time he competes. He's a very complete horse, and he's one we bred ourselves. I bought the mother from VDL Stud in Holland. I had some dealings with him a number of years ago, and now and again they advertised some mares for sale, and I saw this mare. She was a half sister of Boobaloo. She's by Acrobat 2 out of a Nymador Lady Killer mother, and she's got 5 brothers that jump 160. So I straight away inquired about her and bought her. I didn't breed this horse. He has my name on the book, but the mare was in foal as a Val when I bought her, and she's been a very good mare. We've bred a lot from her, and she probably makes up the biggest part of our breeding program now. But Zabayoni is the first one out of her, and he was fifth in the 4-star yesterday, and he's one of the horses on the list for WEG. He could be, I think, anybody that's seen him from the different phases, from dressage, from show jumping, or from eventing, they all said he could be a top horse in any phase, even the eventer people. You know, he wants to do the right job as well. So he's a really great horse. I hope that he can continue the way he's going and make some good results. He's only 10 still. So his career is ahead of him. Then the younger gun in my string is a horse called Kilroe Tiger that I bought from Morris Coleman. As a 4-year-old, he won in Mill Street the Eventing Championships at the International Horse Show with Sean Coleman. He's by a relatively unknown stallion called Hype, with Tangelo Voltaire. And he's out of a Master Imp, Cool Corran, Cool Diamond, Cult Hero mother, as far as I can tell or remember. And he was a very nice horse when we bought him. Again, I didn't know if he had all the power and scope to be a top level horse, but he's proving that he is. He did Le Lion. He was placed there. He was placed in his first 4-star. He was placed again yesterday, seventh in the big four-star class in Aston the Wolds. He was an interesting horse. He was very shy character, very sharp, a lot of master imp reaction, very sharp about clipping or strange people or injections. Everything was anything new was very, very difficult with him, and you really had to take your time. He's now really quite thrusting, and also in the riding at the beginning, he was quite meek and quite shy. But I think that's he's a really exceptionally good horse. He's very fast. He's has his own technique, like a lot of the Tangelo horses in front, but wants to jump clear. And naturally, probably the fastest horse that I have. So I think he's 9 years old now, and I think he can be a top horse for the future.
Did you have to change much in your approach and how you produced a horse like that? Just when you're saying he's a little shyer or less precocious, we'll call it. Did you change much or have to adapt much in how you produce that horse?
I think I've changed a lot since I started eventing anyway, because I spent a large portion of my life riding for dealers. So for those early years in the show jumping, I maybe had a different grounding than a lot of the top riders that are coming through the sport now, where it's always about the sport. When you're riding for a dealer, it's often about making results today and tomorrow so that the horse can be sold and making the horse look nice. And that's something I certainly had to learn from, learned a lot from my wife, Lucy, and many, many people, and also from many horses, especially getting the opportunity to work with horses over a longer period, like Lady Ophelia. Now I have 7 or 8 years, and to see how they change from 8 to 9 to 10. Even now, she's still changing at 13, 14. Everything is becoming easy for her, easier for her. And I think that's probably something I didn't have enough of an awareness for. And I think it's a fault in a lot of young people that, especially in Ireland, where we are very focused on selling, very easy to write off a horse. And the qualities that I spoke about a minute ago, the will to do the right job. I think if you nurture that and give the horse time and a chance and build them up slowly and properly, and never push them beyond what they're ready for in that moment, I think you can get a lot more out of a horse than you'd ever imagine, And equally, if you go to the well too soon and too much when they're young, you don't have it there later. So that's the other fascinating thing about working with horses, is that every day you're learning, and you learn so much from every horse. And I think when I get to nearly 50 years old now, I'm actually relearning and getting excited about stuff that I've forgotten about that I knew 10 years ago, which is, I don't know if that's sad or exciting, but it keeps me motivated anyway.
With your Zaval horse, because again, another interesting thing is you are someone who now has a lot of experience in both disciplines, a lot of interest in both disciplines, even in watching your breeding program from afar or chats you would have over the years. It feels like it's not one or the other has dominated the breeding program, as in there's you seem to always be keeping an eye on both. But with the likes of that Acrobat mare, is it Viancara or Riancara? It's Ankara anyway.
It's me, Ankara.
Viancara. So with her Zaval, at what point was that Zaval focused more in the direction of eventing? Because it could have been very easy for a horse bred like that and out of the family that's out of it has produced multiple 160 horses, would have been very easy to just solely focus that down a show jumping career. Was it a conscious decision to produce that and the eventing route, or was it based on what the horse was telling you or showing you at a particular point in time that you
I think it
decided to
was
go that route?
probably the horse is such a good mover, and he's a very light athletic type that he always looked like he could really do well in eventing. So when he was four, we broke him, and he looked really beautiful, lovely to ride, lovely balance. And at that point, then I put a video of him I took him up the road to do a little cross country schooling, and I put that on the internet. And I had like five phone calls within an hour, and some strong offers to buy the horse straight away. Fortunately for me, very good owners, Peter Cattell and Di Brunsdon, they stepped in and they bought the horse at that point straight away. He'd never been anywhere, just once up the road to do some cross country. He'd never been to a show. And they bought him, and he's been a fantastic horse ever since, so I was lucky that we could keep him, and he's been a good flagship for me and a great horse to compete. He won Blenheim as an 8-year-old. He's won a lot. He's won at every level, and I'm very lucky that I still have him.
You have a promising young horse in partnership with Trevor Breen by Casago. Is that out of the same mare?
But that's the same area. She's 7 years old. She's jumping now at 140 level. It's a mare with a lot of quality. She's very, very green for her age. She Trevor bought her at the end of her 4 year-old year when she was just broken. I had bred a foal from her when she was three by Utamaro. He's a 3 year-old now. And then when Trevor bought her, he didn't need a green horse in his program, so he said to me to keep her here and do the eventing training stuff, and we hack a lot out and ride on the moor. He was very keen for her to do all that she got a kind of a rounded education.
Yeah.
And we continued to take embryos in partnership together, so we have four more. Actually, no, I have one Staccato Gold 2 year-old that I have, and then we have three together, I think. We have an Hermitage Cologne out of her. We have Ansang De Lee. And we have a drummer TN. So we had five offspring off her, and now she's full time with Trevor. She came back to me for the winter while he was in Dubai. Might happen again this winter, I don't know, but she's doing the right things. But she's still green, but she looks like she has the talent to be a very good one.
When you have those promising young fillies coming through, is it something that you would regularly do, cover them at three and let them carry a foal?
Then I did. I don't know if I would. With her, I suppose at the time I was conscious that, and she always looked like a very nice one, and you're always then worried, I suppose, that they're going to be sold at four or five. So I did cover her. I think some mares can handle it better than others. I think the breeding as young horses, I think she took a lot of time, and I think is still developing physically from having the foal. It can make some of them a little bit weaker. I've had other ones that didn't seem to affect, but I think if I had a mare that I wanted to focus on for sport, I might be more tempted to do the embryos than actually letting them carry a foal themselves. That's certainly what I've done subsequently. But yeah, I think it's good. It's great to keep it going quickly down the lines, but I'm not sure that I would be too keen to breed the what I would think would be the best ones unless I wanted to leave them in sport. I have done that with a couple of other sisters. I have an Agonix mare that is out of the Ankara as well that we never broke, and she looks like a very, very good breeder. We're focusing a lot on her at the moment. Her first one by Staccato Gold is in Ireland. It's 5 years old with Ethan Ahern, Camilla Spears, and I think they think very highly of him. And I've got a nice 4 year-old by Chinchero. I have E Pleaser Van Tyke that I own a partnership with Jack Ryan. I have an Agonix this year. I have very good Agonix colt, actually, a foal, and I have a 2 year-old Eurycast van de Katevenen gelded. And this year we have a Mosito pregnancy for next year. We have a frozen embryo by Katoki, which we implanted and has taken, that was done with ICSI in the winter. And I'm implanting on Thursday a Comilfo also from her. So I think she looks like she breeds very good jumpers. And I think what I like about her, and you get that with the Agonix mares, that she has real strength in her body, which sometimes is missing a little bit in the Holstein breeding. They're beautiful types and they have great movement, but sometimes that real strength in the body is maybe is not always there, and that I think is you get that with the Darko blood from Agonix.
Can you give me a bit of an overview in terms of the size of your breeding program at the moment and how many mares you would primarily focus on breeding jumpers and how many you would primarily focus on breeding eventers?
I think 2 years ago we had 14 foals, or 3 years ago. We had then a couple of difficult years. It's looking better again now. But this year, for instance, we only bred three foals. We did lose one in, or it's reabsorbed. But with mares being infected, we had big problems. And I think we've got on top of that now. My ideal, I think, would be 10 to 12 to breed every year. So again, we probably, like a lot of people and listening to your podcast as well, they start maybe with a lot of different mares and they see what works for them and they kind of refine it. So at the moment I have from that family of Viancara is still alive actually, and I probably do. He doesn't normally start cycling until later in the year, she spent the last 5 or 6 years with John Haughey in the north of Ireland, and that was a very good partnership. But she's back here now. She's 24, but she's in very good health. I'll try her once this month, and if she doesn't take, she can just stay and live out her days here. I have two daughters here breeding from her. One is the Agonix mare, and one is a Lovisto mare. The Lovisto mare is this year in foal to a young stallion that Shane Breen has called Dom Twist. He's a Dominator, Gemini, and then a full sister to Fletcher van Verhoef. I think Shane thinks a lot of them, and it's also very interesting blood for eventing. The Lovisto mare is maybe a bit more stronger type. And with that mare, I'm kind of experimenting a little bit. She's a very good moving mare. This year I gave her blood because I want to see maybe she can breed an eventer, but that horse also jumps very good. With the breeding, I sometimes have a very clear idea. If I think if I use that stallion, I'm definitely going to get more of a jumper. But a lot of the time I'm just trying to breed a nice athletic horse, because that horse will always have a job in eventing or jumping. You know, if the horse doesn't make 160, you want a very nice riding horse that it can be sold to America, has good balance, has good rideability. That's something I would try and pay attention to. Of course, if you use some stallions, you know that you mightn't get all of that, but you get the if they have maybe a great chance of being a top jumper. So I have the Lovisto mare and the Agonix mare out of the Ankara. I have five offspring of the Casago mare. We have also a Contargis Chaco Blue mare, and that was one that I had in a partnership with Paul O'Shea. He jumped the mother. She was called Scarra Glen Sienna. She was a good 5-star mare. The Contargis, she's young. Again, we broke her, but put her straight into breeding, and she'll stay in the breeding. She had her first foal last year was by Drummer. We have a colt, a yearling, and this year we have a very good Anzang de Lee colt out of her. And she's now Scandon foal to Calestis. So this mare normally would breed in jumpers, I hope.
I
And
think that's
then
funny when you said you had a Contargis Chaco Blue. I was thinking, okay, yeah, same. And then I was curious to see what you bred her to, and you had bred her to Drummer. And I was thinking, same. I had a Drummer last year from it as well. So that's funny.
okay,
Yeah.
interesting. So she's a mare that you would hope could breed some good jumpers. And I have another mare. She's called Estaminka van het Gerendel from the breeding of Ben Verhey. She's a half sister to a horse that a lot of people in Ireland would probably know called Viminka, that was a very good Grand Prix jumper with the Butler brothers.
Butlers.
And she was also in her own right a good brood mare. She's also a sister to Agana van het Gerendel that Lily Keenan rode, and there was a few more. So it's a very strong family. It's the family of the Dokus and a lot of good horses. I bred a Ganesh out of her. That's a very nice jumper, not so big. And I have a Durkhan Hero 3-year-old. I think she's in Ireland that I still own in partnership with Jack Ryan. She looks like a very nice filly. And this year we did some ICSI with her. She's a little bit difficult to breed with, but she was very successful with the ICSI. We got two United Touch embryos, one which we've implanted and has taken, thankfully, and one which we'll implant next week. And also, I bought a mare last year. It's a bit of a flight of fancy, and that is an eventing mare. She's by Rock King out of a full thoroughbred mare, so she's 90% thoroughbred. Rock King, in his own right, wasn't a particularly good stallion, or he didn't leave a lot of top horses, but seems to be very prolific on the dam sire. A lot of people would know him as the dam sire of Colorado Mare from Ulster, Lordship Scruffalo, Menlo Park from Clark Johnston, Chilly Knight, Chilly's Jester, Supercilious, Calvino, that was 4-star with Tina Cook. Like, it turns up every time, again and again, on the dam sire. So I met Sarah Bullen, the breeder of Rock King, last year at Bicton Horse Show, and I asked her if she hadn't have any straws left of Rock King, and she said she had five straws left, and she had a 2-year-old filly, which there would be very few of around. So I bought the Rock King filly straight away, more or less unseen, and in the deal I got a straw of Rock King as well in the deal. So at the moment we're working on getting her in foal. We started the conversation speaking about Instant Karma and Jimmy Ryan's family, and I recently bought a mare by Flexible out of a half sister of the mother of Instant Karma. So she's Flexible Clover Hill, Delamain. And she came actually from Ireland via Holland through Alan Waldman back to England, and I have her, and she's a real flexible. She's a sharp lady. You wouldn't move too fast or speak too loudly around her. But I like sharp mares. Again, going back to Max Howie's comment, and I'm thinking she has Alan has a very nice Dorado out of her, and I'll probably use Dorado or potentially even Duplex for try her and once for in the eventing lines.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to think what else I have. I think that's kind of it. I'm looking forward. Like I bought a nice filly last year online from the mother line of Ito de Chateau. It's Cerro Blue, Diamant mare. She's the mother's a full sister to a 160 jumper that Peter Fredrickson has. So I'm trying as well to get into some more bloodlines that, I think it's good to keep. On one hand, I'm saying I'm maybe focusing more and more on the family of Biancaro, but I think it's still interesting to try and bring in other bloodlines.
I think it's been interesting, even in what you've mentioned here in previous discussions, in what I've seen online, where you'll be using stallions that are that mix or almost dual purpose, or there'll be a jumping stallion, but a lot of thoroughbred up close, like you mentioned, Shane Breen's Don Stallion that was out of the Gemini Mother, the Don VHB Stallion, Gemini, Amiro N for a while, Herald a good bit. So I think that's quite interesting, and that's why I wanted to just tease this out to see the thought process, because I know I don't believe you're someone who's going to be making these decisions on a whim. I think there's a lot of thinking has gone into your various different combinations and experiments as well. For the eventing, and you mentioned Duplex as well, who's a very interesting option for the eventing breeders. But are there other stallions? Because a lot of my interviews to date have been obviously very heavy on show jumping orientated and on show jumping breeders, and I'm often conscious that there's probably hasn't been enough discussion for the eventing breeders. Are there other stallions that you think are interesting that are kind of on your radar, either that you have or haven't used, but that you think should be really interesting for for breeding eventers, or that you're seeing a lot of very nice young horses or young event horses coming through from that breeders should be keeping an eye on?
I think I don't know if this is a me thing or is something that a lot of breeders can familiarize. I latch onto a stallion for a period and I will use them a good bit and get a feel for how they produce. And then, like, I have a good bunch of Amiros in the field, and I started using him because I was at an event one day and I saw what I thought were two really, really good horses, 5 years old. One of them is Cor Amiro that was placed in Badminton this year. And another one was a horse that Oliver Townend ended up riding at four-star, and I think she got injured. She was called Caunt in first class. She won the Burling event horse class after that as a 5 year old. And to me, they looked like real event horses, and he's also standing 20 minutes away from me. So it was a very easy option to use him, and he gave blood. And what I liked about them when I bred the foals was they all looked similar. You kind of knew what you were going to get. So I have five, six, seven Amiros in the field that some we have started now. And of course, when you use a stallion, you then very quickly become, or not very quickly maybe, but you start to see the traits, what you like, and maybe also things that you think you have to be careful for when you're using a stallion. I used Herald for a while because I thought he was an interesting way of bringing blood in for eventers when you're trying to breed eventers. And there was, his mother also bred another 160 jumper from a different thoroughbred, so I thought there was strength in the line. I have to say I bred some lovely Heralds, but I didn't always get what I thought I was going to get. It didn't always give blood. Sometimes made very big ones, sometimes made very small ones. So I stopped using him because you like a stallion that stamps them. Now I have a very, very good 4 year old by Herald that I think is a very, very good horse, but it's hard to use a stallion that you can't match it, You like to have an idea in your head when you breed that you're gonna, yeah, if I use that, I'm gonna get that. But it doesn't always work out like that, of course. But with Herald, there was too much variance in it for my liking. And I'm also, and that's why I think I bought the blood mare last year. I've always really liked, and I really love riding blood horses. I think it's important for whatever sport, for jumping or for eventing, that you have blood, that you keep hardness and willingness to go forward. And But of course, it's very difficult nowadays to pick a thoroughbred stallion that you think that mightn't give jump, but at least won't take it away, because we have no way of testing them. There's sadly, it was a huge mistake in Ireland that we didn't somehow ring fence the good thoroughbred jumping blood and protect it, because the racing boys, the only thing they care about is how fast they run. And we had thoroughbred stallions that could breed jumpers, but I don't know where to look anymore. I think, we've seen it. They've slipped out of Ireland and been very successful in other countries. Stand the Man, I think Jack the Robin left for Holland, and he looked like a horse that could breed some jumpers. But so I suppose, to make a long story short, I think it's, as a breeder, to breed an event horse, it's probably easier to start with a blood mother and then bring in the jumping qualities and the movement you need from the stallion. Because at least if you have a thoroughbred mare and you test her and you know she can jump, then you have a much better chance, I think, of breeding what you want if you can match her with the right stallion. And also, the sport has changed. I mean, like, a lot of what we need and what we see nowadays is the sport is divided, and it's the eventing is a little bit, I'd say, at a bit of a crisis in terms of identity. A 5-star horse is not always a 4-star horse, and a championship horse is not, is rarely a 5-star horse, can be. But they're the questions you have to ask yourself. Are you trying to breed a 5-star horse, or are you trying to breed an eventer that can win a gold medal at an Olympic? And also, that horse will be much more commercial as a young horse, because like Lady Ophelia that I spoke about in the beginning, she can't do dressage, but she can jump in around the toughest cross country course and be fast and jump a clear round on the last day. It's difficult, I think, for the eventing breeders, and I think that's where I'm lucky, because I can also ride and produce, and if they're not to be sold, I can see a long term vision for them, and if I produce them the 5-star, they will also be clients for them. But that's not really interesting for a lot of breeders, because they can't afford to put them with somebody to keep them that long. So I think if I was starting out to breed an eventer, I would say to people, find as nice a blood mare as you can, and then use the stallions that show up time and again in eventing breeding.
So I'm sure as a rider, you'd love to be able to keep all the best young horses that either come through your hands or come from your own breeding program, but you also have a larger business to run and family to look after. So there's still a lot of, I guess, trade alongside your sport career. You're also someone who's always keeping an eye out for what's around, what's coming through, what's available outside of your own gates as well, back and forth to Ireland when something nice crops up. Are you actively solely looking for young event prospects, or do you also have a similar eye out for young jumpers?
Probably don't have my radar out for young jumpers as much. I'm really trying to breed nice ones that either can be sold, or at least if the mares, I would like ultimately to do in partnership with people that I can let them become better horses, and maybe get some embryos out of them before they're sold, and I'd like to see them go on. But I think for me to buy in horses, it's generally eventers that I would try and do, because where I'm based in England, we don't have show centres, so to go to a jumping show, it takes time, and the commitment to being an event rider primarily is very heavy on your time. You're away often 4 days in the week, and we're also, like I said, I'm hoping that through our own breeding program we can have nice jumpers. I'd love to have a jumper here all the time, and I think we've bred some good ones and are continuing to do so. So no, I'm not really looking for them on the outside, but I would actively look for eventers, and either whether they're bought for me or whether I can source them and sell them to other people. And like you said, we're still have a business to run. So like, I think I'm always, everything is for sale here. And I love selling horses. I love seeing our horses going to good riders. I get great satisfaction. Like, we spoke earlier about, having two homebreds on the Nations Cup team in Bicton recently. So that, I get an enormous sense of satisfaction from that, and seeing various top riders winning competitions with our horses. And also in that is, I'm acutely aware that I'm not going to be riding forever, and I want people to know that now is the time that I, need to sow the seeds of what I can hopefully reap later, that here is a place where you can come to buy good young horses. And that'll be what I'll do probably into my later years.
I was curious with that in terms of if jumpers were something you're looking for versus eventers, or was it solely focused on eventers? Because I guess my follow-up question to that was, so it's you've talked about if someone was starting out trying to breed eventers, how you think they should do it. You've talked about how you've tried to approach it in your own breeding program. But then when your buyer hat is on, or your rider hat, and you're going out trying to find either, a really nice young eventer that can be bought and sold on to help the business, or something that can be bought as a prospect, maybe for one of your owners for your own career. How much of a weight does pedigree come in your personal, I guess, case or opinion, when you're buying a young event horse prospects, how much weight does the pedigree carry?
Because I'm interested in it, it's one of the first questions I will ask is how the horse bred is bred. Maybe that's the wrong question. First, you should judge the horse. But there would be stallions or breeding that I would think we don't see in eventing. One of them I can say because it's not going to hurt his career. He's already been one of the best stallions in the world, is Cornet Oblensky, for instance. If somebody rang me up and said they have a Cornet Oblensky as an eventer, I'd say, that's nice for you, but it's not for me, you know. He doesn't have the traits that I want, not for an eventer. And while they might look beautiful and they can be good movers, you don't see them in top sport. And so that's enough. Like, he's bred thousands and thousands of horses and thousands of, hundreds of top jumpers. But you would struggle, I would struggle to name one that's in eventing. There's plenty of them that do it at a low level. So, I mean, that's an extreme example. But because I'm interested in it, I do like to see for myself some thoroughbred XX on the page. Doesn't have to be, but it would certainly, tickle my interest a bit more. Like my Kilroe Tiger horse, he's 63% thoroughbred, and you do feel it when you ride that horse cross country that he just runs very easily. It's a very natural thing for him to do. But then, the downside of that is the dressage takes a little bit more work. What's conformationally makes it easy for them to gallop doesn't always make them easy to do collected work. But it's a thing that's our job to train them. And I bought a new mare recently from Ireland, a 4-year-old that I think you're aware of, by U Dancer Hero. He was winning now the Young Eventor series from Ciara Kinsella. And she again is a mare that when you ride her, she's very electric, very sharp, very sensitive, with quick reflexes, and is just always on her own legs. And that's an expression I say a lot to people, that I like horses that are on their own legs, so they don't have to manage their balance a lot. That's my own personal preference. You see many different horses eventing, but I want to feel safe. I want to be able to be competitive, and to be able to be competitive, you have to ride fast. And I don't want to be cantering against the fence and have the feeling that the horse isn't going to have a quick reaction. If I don't see a perfect stride, is the horse going to have that fifth leg and be able to help me a little bit, or just handle themselves in a way that makes me comfortable? I see a lot of people managing horses that and doing great jobs and being successful on horses that I think, I wouldn't like to ride that horse. So everybody has their own idea what an eventer is. I certainly like to ride a horse that's reactive and that runs easily, and I don't have to always manage them in front of the jump, and certainly the blood can help with that. Now again, of course, I've ridden blood horses that wouldn't gallop out of their own way or wouldn't jump a stick. But when it all comes together in the pedigree, when you have the right mix and the horse is athletic, and again, for us, because we fitness is so important, when they have blood, it becomes easier for them, but it also takes less out of them because they're built to run. So yeah, there is no magic formula, but it definitely helps if you see the horse you want and he has some blood there and they have that lightness about them. Yeah, would be for me important, I think, so the breeding. But I have made mistakes on breeding before, don't get me wrong. And because I saw something that I liked in the horse, but maybe I needed to be convinced to buy him, and maybe the pedigree did it for me. And yeah, you live by your mistakes, But I don't think I'd leave a horse behind because I didn't love the pedigree, unless it was by a stallion that I didn't think could possibly make an event for him.
Are there a few particular things that, as a type, that you really love to see? And similarly, are there some things that, if they're there in terms of physically, that you'll be really put off?
Yeah, certainly there's, I mean, confirmation is important. Like, so for me, it starts with the feet. If the horse doesn't have good feet, I'd be very, very quick to walk away from a horse with odd feet. And sadly, it's something that you see a lot in certain breeds. And what's more disappointing is that for me, at least, if you go to the effort of seeing a horse that you can arrive after flying 2 hours somewhere, that people will never even mention the fact that the horse has very odd feet. And several times I've just said, look, not for me. They just take too much punishment in our sports. So general conformation, like, you know, they need to have requisite bone to carry their body. Nice pastures without too much slope. But then the rest of it is a little bit coming down to, and this is a, as a rider, you can see the things that will be helpful in some ways that won't be helpful in other ways. You know, sometimes a horse with a high head carriage, it's very nice to ride cross country because they're always in upward balance and you can ride forward. Maybe not so easy for the dressage. A horse with a bit straighter hind leg, maybe typical of the thoroughbreds, run easier and they're quick. For the collected dressage work, it's harder, you know. So it's always trying to see what you can work with. I'd never, there would be some things I would ride a horse off for, like bad feet or, you know, poor conformation of its limbs, you know, legs that are turned out, because it's going to put too much strain on them in the wrong way. But you can live with a lot. And if the horse wants to work and gives you a good feeling when they're riding, you know, you have to be able to see what you as a rider like and what you can deal with and what will be the potential challenges. But ultimately, I'd rather see a horse with a good canter, because I know a good canter and a good walk, because they're harder to change. The trot you can do an awful lot with a horse that has a rhythmical trot developed into a big trot. But the canter, you can do not so much. Especially when in our sport, when you're riding a horse fast for 8, 9 minutes, after 5 minutes they're back to what they do by nature. So that's what you're going to have. So no point fooling yourself about that. And it's comfortable to ride a horse with a good canter. But like I said, the ones that gallop quickly and easily have sometimes a straighter hind leg conformation. But just takes a bit more time for them to learn the engagement and the strength to be able to carry themselves easier.
You'd mentioned the eventing being at a bit of a crossroads in terms of, are you looking for the top 5-star horse or looking for that horse that's maybe has more amateur resale? Where do you, if you were an eventing breeder, thinking of the changes that are likely to be in place, say 10 years on, like if you're covering mares this summer, are there any things that are creeping in that you think are important for people to be considering or reflecting on or incorporating in their either their breeding program or their young horse production systems that you think are going to be really kind of important or influential, maybe 10 years on? Any change in directions?
Well, I think the big change has already started, and I think it's very hard. And you know, you can end up now in a different conversation very quickly. That's what goes down a rabbit hole. But I think like we've changed already the sport a lot, and then because they took away the long format a number of years ago, the dressage became more important. So people started focusing more on horses with good movement, and even dressage horses, of which I've also had a dressage bred horse at a high level, but. Because we've seen more and more focus on the dressage, there is a very obvious reduction in the number of horses that can do tough 5-star cross country easier. This year we had the first time a badminton no wait list. 22 horses started the 5-star in Le Moulin. And that's just because we don't have enough horses now at that level, or people are not producing them. Everybody wants championship horses. So I think the danger then is when there's not enough horses, the courses become easier. And the whole sport gets dumbed down from the top level. I think that's a very dangerous thing, and I think it's something that we need to figure out. I know Sam Watson is recently referring to that in something that he's posted online. Because I think if the top level, if the badminton and the burley goes, then I think suddenly you're on a slippery slope into what can become just arena eventing as a sport of eventing. Because where does that cycle stop? You know, if we keep reducing the difficulty to reflect the horses we have. The dressage and jumping phases are going to become increasingly more important. At some point, you have to have the clarity to say, well, we need to keep the level of 5-star as it is, where it is now. We need this type of horse, the horse that has blood, and a horse that has the ability to gallop for 12 minutes without falling over the last fence, because we can't. Also, in the era we're in now, and nobody wants to see horses getting injured. Nobody wants to ride and fall off at that level. So you need horses that are capable of doing it. And for that, I think if you look at the statistics of badminton and burlies, and people are quick to shout exceptions, but generally the horses that are doing well there have blood. Generally, of course, there are exceptions. But if you say the horses that make the time in burly generally have a lot of thoroughbred. And that is an exception because it's difficult terrain there. But so getting back to your point, I think as an eventing breeder, if you want to breed a horse that'll have a job, I think it's important if you can to stay close to blood, because they're also will make the right amateur horses in the end, because they're horses that are often easier to ride, and maybe they don't have the power of the big warm bloods, but it's less for people to try and control. I think it's for me, I'd rather have a horse that had less scope that I could ride the scope into, ride quicker, rather than have too much scope and trying to be worried about if I come in a combination that has a short landing and then again a tight distance to something. I don't want to be thinking, is the horse going to overjump and then be too close and maybe put me in a dangerous position? So, like I said, I like a horse that is able to handle himself and be on his own balance. And of course, we see some warm bloods that are able to do it as well. And I'm aware that the sport now requires warm blood breeding and jumpers and movers, but I think we don't need to stray too far from the lightness and the quickness. And I think that's where I think we're probably evolving to now horses that have are warm bloods but are sharper, quicker types. Because I've been to events before, high level events, and I've seen people trotting around, and I thought, I don't think I'd like to ride that horse. And then you see them have a bad fall in cross country, and you think, like, the horse isn't built to do that sport. And I think sometimes when you see young people, they're very ambitious, and you might be the only horse they've got, and they don't know any difference. I think that's where, when you get older, you get more experience, and you don't want to hit the ground too much. Certainly true of myself. So I like to feel safe cross country. That's my. When I look at a horse, I first and foremost think, can I ride that horse quick over a big cross country track? And then, can I see it doing the rest good enough to become a good horse, you know?
As you'll know from some of the other episodes, I like to finish each interview I do with people, either for the Big Talk series or different breeders' talks, by getting advice from the guest for the next generation coming through. And it's typically for the next generation of people in a similar space, so either riders for riders or breeders for breeders. In your case, I'd like both, if you wouldn't mind. So, for young riders that are listening, I'd like to know what advice would you offer them in terms of establishing themselves in the sport horse world or making a successful career. And then afterwards, I'd like to touch on some more general advice. We've talked a lot about how the eventing breeder should be thinking, but if there are broader pieces of advice that you give to breeders in general, show jumping or eventing, in terms of how you feel they should be approaching the breeding of sport horses in 2026 and beyond. I'd like to just touch on those two pieces of advice. So, any advice for the young riders coming through in the sport, be that show jumping or eventing, just coming through in the sport horse world, and then similarly for breeders.
Advice is always a difficult thing to give, isn't it? Because, you know, everybody has their own opinions, and I've only lived my life, but I think you can't be afraid of work. And what has stood to me and what keeps me up every morning is not necessarily the competition. It's just working with the horses. I've always got great satisfaction out of it, and I think I recognize that because we have a big yard, and we have we have a lot of people come to us over the years to at the beginning of the career, and you get a sense quite early of the ones that are going to have a chance to go on, because they see, you know, that it takes a lot of effort, and that you have to walk before you can run. I think, and again, having a dealing yard here, we have a lot of riders coming, and not a dealing yard, we're not a big dealing yard, but we have sold a lot to good riders that are out successful at a high level. It's interesting to see them riding a young horse that they're really quite at sea, and it's quite a surprise because you recognize them from riding good at big events. So I think that's that ability to be able to produce horses correctly from the beginning is a skill that is maybe getting a little bit lost. We've a lot of top riders, young people that can get in the ring and win good classes. But is there the one, the willingness to learn how it goes from the beginning, and the knowledge? And that takes time, and it takes experience, and it takes the effort, I think. And I think I would encourage people to, where possible, lean on people that have been very good at that. There's some exceptionally good producers in Ireland, and try and get the different experience when you're young. It's easy to look around and compare yourself to other people that are doing well, but it is a marathon. It's not really a sprint. You can do it for a long time, You're not jumping 160 at 21. You haven't missed a boat, I think you can take your time to learn your trade, and if you become good, you will get opportunities, but I think you have to be prepared to, especially if you don't have maybe the financial wherewithal. I think if you put in the effort and you have some talent that can grow with it, you will get the opportunities.
And I know you're someone that will be aware of a lot of breeders and breeding programs around the world. You engage with different breeders in different countries, either connected to the mares you have or horses you're interested in. But if you're looking at the breeding space as a whole, is there anything that we haven't touched on in the conversation that you think breeders should be doing more of? Paying more attention to, or even doing less of? Is there something that you often see kind of reoccurring that you think, if you could leave breeders with, and as you just said, this is your opinion, but as a rider competing at a high level and as someone actively involved in breeding, are there a piece of advice that you'd love to leave breeders around the world with?
Listening to your podcast over the last couple of years, I think it's largely the same sentiments from most people. I think you have to have an idea in your mind what you want to breed. I think where people like me who can do the full cycle, the riding and the breeding, like I know the type of horse that I like to ride, and I know the vaguely what I would like to breed. Of course, it doesn't always work, and we're always adapting and changing a little bit. And the good people in the sport horse world, they're doing an amazing job. Like in Ireland, the breeding is getting stronger and stronger. There's some fantastic horses coming out of Ireland. Like we saw now, James Cantrews winning unbelievable Grand Prix in Falsterbo yesterday. Unbelievable horse, from great breeders in the Connollys. So I don't need to give people at the top level any advice. I'm still in my own mind just a baby breeder starting out, and just somebody who's been fascinated with horses all my life. But the mistake that when I came over here, there were horses in the breeding with Lucy and her family that were not good enough as sport horses, or they were lame, and they ended up in their breeding system because they didn't know what else to do with them. And I see younger people, because a lot of people know that I breed, and they come and talk to me about this mare they put in foal or that mare. And that's a mistake that I think a lot of young people make, is that they have a horse that went lame or was too difficult, and they just breed with it. And because then they put Hermitage Cologne on or coming forward, they think they're going to breed a superstar, and sadly it doesn't work like that. We all know now that, okay, you can't breed a top jumper with a bad stallion, but if you don't have a good mare, it doesn't matter what you put on it, because that's so important, the mother line. And so that would be, again, just echoing the sentiment of a lot of people, focus on whatever means you can to get into a good mare, or just don't breed off the bad ones. That's a complete waste of time. It's too expensive, and you'll be 4 or 5 years down the line before you recognize your mistakes. And sadly, the best lessons are the ones you make yourselves. But you don't need to, like, look to the good breeders, see what they do, take their advice, and breed from a sound horse. That's very important. There's stallions there as well that we know, and I'm not going to name any names, but if somebody told me there's a very good one by that stallion, I'd say, well, you don't see them in sport after 10 years old. They can be as talented as they want, but they're not hard, they're not sound. So, and they passed it on, and don't fool yourself. And now we see it a lot. Some of the stud books are, publishing the X-ray reports from the stallions, and mightn't be always completely accurate, but it does give you an indication. And I think there's definitely a genetic component to things like that. But even besides the X-rays, I mean, they only tell part of the picture. I think a sound horse ultimately is a sound horse. But if you have a mare that went lame as a 6-year-old in sport, don't waste your time breeding from her.
And that's super. And I'm very grateful that you took the time to do this. I know sitting down to be interrogated for an hour plus wasn't high on your list of things you wanted to do, but I really appreciate you taking the time for a few reasons. As breeders, we're not always great at reaching out to or engaging or going up to speaking to riders, but they're the very people that we're breeding these horses for. So it's so important to hear the perspectives of riders competing at a high level, but then to have a rider who's so interested in breeding. In your mind, you're to a degree, you're like a breeder that can ride at a high level because you're as interested as someone who's breeding full time. And I think that's really good. The reoccurring theme that has come up is the willingness to kind of say yes to things or take opportunities as they come and kind of get stuck in, I think is a great message to people. But as I mentioned earlier in the conversation, why I really see the kind of more holistic value of this conversation for the people that are going to listen to it is again that reminder of, regardless of the twists and turns and pivots that are going to come, it's not always a straight line, and there can still be an incredible life or career in horses for you, even if it's not obvious in the moment that you're listening to this conversation. But I just hope that it kind of lights a fire in people, because I really think it will. I think it'll give a lot of inspiration to people, and I really appreciate the level of detail and depth that you've given to the conversation.
Well, I hope so. I mean, it's very easy for me to start waffling, especially when you ask me questions about breeding. And I think we all are in our own bubbles, but I've got a lot of listening out of listening to some of your podcasts, and hopefully somebody maybe somewhere will find some part of what I said vaguely useful.
If you enjoyed this episode or any of the previous episodes, why not send it to a friend or share it on your social media?